All righty, we're going to pick it up on session 31, lesson 6, page 11 in your harmony, section 91 in your, section 91 in the harmony and page 11 in the outline. All right, let's do a little bit of review to get us up to speed. We're in the section of the life of Messiah that is the most important incident in his life as apart from his death and resurrection. One extremely busy day. We're only halfway through that day right now. It began by going to Capernaum and being besieged by such a mob of people that they couldn't even eat. Remember that comment? Performing miracles. Then the Pharisees came, and Jesus healed the man of the demon of muteness, a messianic sign. The Pharisees then rejected that sign and committed the unpardonable sin. The unpardonable sin, we derive from the context, is the national rejection of the messiahship of Jesus while he was physically present on the grounds that he was demon-possessed. And of course, there are consequences to that decision. And the first consequence, and the most severe one, is that a physical judgment is now set against that generation. That judgment cannot be alleviated. It is unpardonable. And we will see by the end of our class, by the end of the life of the Messiah, that this judgment is the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in AD 70. So that's one consequence of the unpardonable sin. The other consequence is changes in the Messiah's ministry as a result of this decision, result of this rejection. First of all, in the area of signs. Previously, the signs were for the nation. Now, signs will be given, but they're for the training of the 12, no longer for the nation in general. Secondly, in the area of miracles, previously, the miracles were done for the masses, but now miracles will be performed for individuals in response to personal need on the basis of faith. We'll see a big change there. And I was often confused as I read through the Gospels before I took this class many years ago why things were so different from miracle to miracle. But this explains it very nicely, especially when you see it in its chronological sequence. Yes, question?
Is that information
in the book? Yeah. This is all in your outline.
Okay.
What page? I'd have to go look back a few lessons.
520.
Who's got that? Page 4, Lesson 6. Okay? All right. In the area of message, previously he was proclaiming that he's the Messiah and he's offering to Israel the kingdom, but now the proclamation and offer to the nation pauses. And finally, in teaching method, previously he taught in clear propositional truth, for example, the Sermon on the Mount. Now he teaches in parables. In parables. So we began to march through those parables, and last week we began to look at them. We began with the parable of the soils. A sower went out to sow, and his seed fell on, the gospel seed fell on, four types of soil. First of all, the hard hearts, the people who are not interested in the gospel and just ignore it. Secondly, the shallow soil, the people that had an initial interest, but they're scandalized, offended by the gospel seed when they learn what it is. Thirdly, the soil full of weeds. Again, people interested, they don't get offended, but the cares and distractions of the world overpower the seed and it is choked off and it does not bear fruit. And then the final type of soil, those people who are interested, they are not scandalized by the gospel. They do not allow the cares and distractions of the world to overpower them, and they bear fruit, 30, 60, or 100 fold. So that was the first parable. Then came the parable of the seed's spontaneous growth. And just as a seed grows in good soil, so the gospel seed will sprout in good soil. And mankind has nothing to do with it. We plant a seed, we leave it alone, it grows. And God does that with his gospel seed as well. Thirdly, we came to the parable of the tares. Along with the sowing of the good seed, there will be a false counter sowing. and the two plants that are sown in the same field will grow together until the harvest. And in the harvest time, the difference between the two seeds will be readily apparent because of the fruit or lack of fruit that each plant produces. And here you see a wheat field, and the wheat, the good seed, bowed over, heavily burdened down by their fruit, and the weeds standing up straight and tall, easily identified. And here's another close-up of a wheat field in that same condition, with the wheat heavily burdened down by their load of fruit. Then came the parable of the mustard tree, the mustard seed, one of the smallest of seeds, tiny little thing, but it can grow to huge outer proportions, and birds can rest in its branches. Then we came to the parable of the leavened loaf. A woman kneaded leaven into three measures of meal. Then the parable of the hid treasure. A man found treasure hidden in a field, and we examined that idea, and we learned that the treasure hidden in the field is a symbol of Israel. Israel is God's special treasure. And then we looked at the pearl of great price, and we concluded that the pearl represents the Gentiles. Gentiles will enter the kingdom as well. And I concluded with the application that each one of us, Jew and Gentile alike, are a precious jewel in God's treasure chest. No second-class citizens in the kingdom. Just like that trove of treasure that was found in Megiddo, each one of us is a valuable, valuable jewel in God's treasure chest. So don't think of yourself as anything less than that. All righty, that brings us then to section 91. And we're at the bottom of page 11, lesson 6 in your outline. And section 91 is toward the bottom of page 86 in your harmony. Now Matthew covers this. So let's read Matthew chapter 13, verses 47 through 50. Everybody get there okay? All right, verses 47 through 50. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a dragnet cast into the sea, and gathering fish of every kind. And when it was filled, they drew it up on the beach, and they sat down and gathered the good fish into containers, but the bad they threw away. So it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come forth and take out the wicked from among the righteous, and will cast them into the furnace of fire. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So here we come to the parable of the dragnet. Here is a dragnet being utilized at the Sea of Galilee. A dragnet is a unique type of fishing technique. The top of the net is floated, has floats on it, so it floats on the top of the water. But the bottom of the net is weighted, so it sinks to the bottom. So the net is extended out from the shore and then drawn in, gathering the fish inside. As, of course, the weighted bottom runs along the ground and the fish are forced toward the shore. Here's another view of a modern and much smaller dragnet. This one happens to be salmon fishing in England. But the idea, the technique is exactly the same. The fish are caught in the net. All right, that's the way a dragnet works. But the point here is that the end of the age will be characterized by the judgment of the Gentiles. The end of the age will end with the judgment of the Gentiles. We'll look at that much more detail when we get to the end of the Messiah's ministry in the Olivet Discourse. Now the sea is a common symbol in the Bible for the vast Gentile world, the vast surging Gentile world out there. It's used that way in Revelation chapter 13, for example. John sees the dragon standing on the sand of the seashore. Then I saw a beast coming out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads. And on his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. Now the sea is then explained to us in Revelation 17, verse 15. He said to me, The waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. So the vast churning Gentile world is often symbolized by the sea, by the restless churning sea. Daniel used this same symbol in Daniel 7, verses 2 through 7. Daniel said, "I was looking at my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion, and had the wings of an eagle. And we know from the study of Daniel that that is a symbol of the Babylonian Empire. And behold, another beast, the second one, resembling a bear, which is the Medo-Persian Empire. And behold, another one, like a leopard." Well, the Greek Empire also comes out of the vast, churning Gentile sea. "And behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying, extremely strong." The final beast, the final empire, is the Roman Empire again, coming out of the vast sea of humanity. And Isaiah also picks this symbol up in Isaiah 57:20. He says, "The wicked are like the tossing sea, for it cannot be quiet. Its waters toss up refuse and mud." So again, next time you go down to the beach and look out at the Pacific, keep this in mind, that vast Pacific Ocean that you see with the waves churning and moving and tossing up the mud, a picture of the vast, unsaved Gentile world of humanity. All right. So that's a standard, kind of pretty standard symbol in the Bible. So at the judgment of the Gentiles at the end of the age, the righteous Gentiles will enter the kingdom of heaven, and the unrighteous Gentiles will be excluded from the kingdom of heaven. So that is the parable of the dragnet. All right, let's move to the next page in your outline, page 12 and section 92. Yes.
I have a question about that. Where it talks about the Gentiles and the judgment. And that is the post-rapture judgment, right?
The sheep and the goats judgments is at the end of the tribulation.
Yes.
End of the tribulation period. Yeah. Okay. All righty. Section 92. We come to the parable of the householder. Again, Matthew covers this in just two verses, bottom of page 86, section 92. Jesus speaks, "Have you understood all these things?" They said to him, "Yes." And he said to them, "Therefore, every scribe who has become a disciple of the kingdom of heaven is like a head of a household who brings forth out of his treasure things new and old." So this is a summary parable, and the point is on your outline. Some aspects of the mystery kingdom are similar to previous forms of the kingdom, and some aspects of the mystery kingdom are brand new. And then you have a chart on page 12 that puts all of these parables together, I think, in one coherent whole. So let's work through that chart a step at a time. First of all, the aspect that's covered, the aspect of the kingdom, is the mystery form of the kingdom, a form of the kingdom that had not been revealed previously, but Jesus reveals it at this time to his disciples. The time frame for the mystery form of the kingdom, the current age between the first and second coming. So we are in the mystery form of the kingdom right now. The theme of the parables is the course of the kingdom during the current age. This is what the kingdom will look like when the king is absent. He's ruling in the hearts of his subjects, but he is absent, and things will change when he returns. But this is what we are to expect during the mystery form of the kingdom. So we start with the parable of the sower and the characteristic. The age is characterized by the sowing of the gospel seed, but limited response. So evangelism is a very important part of the mystery form of the kingdom. Secondly, we come to the seed growing of itself. The gospel seed has an inner energy and it will spring to life of its own accord. And this is the power of regeneration. The power of regeneration that's contained in that simple little message that Jesus came, died, buried, rose again for our sins. And how can a simple message like that have such power? But that's what Paul reiterates in Romans 1:16. He says, I am not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. So that little message has tremendous power behind it, the power of God himself. Then we come to the parable of the tares. We learn in that parable that the mystery form of the kingdom will be characterized by a false counter-sowing. So there'll be opposition to the gospel seed. An enemy sows a false gospel, opposition. The fourth parable, the mustard seed. The kingdom will grow to huge outer proportions and experience direct attack by Satan's agents. So the kingdom, which starts very small, Jesus and 12 men, pretty small beginning, right? Pretty small seed, will grow huge, but there will be attacks by Satan's agents. So there'll be growth and persecution will be part of this kingdom age. Then the parable of the leaven, there will be inward doctrinal error in the kingdom. Error and disunity will also be part of this kingdom age. Now notice those are the public parables uttered to the public, but not explained to the public. They're explained privately to the disciples, and then he launches into four more parables that are shared privately with the disciples, again to teach them and to prepare them for the ministry that they are going to have when he leaves. So parable number 6, the hidden treasure, speaking of Israel. Nevertheless, in spite of the opposition, in spite of the persecution, in spite of the error, in spite of the disunity, Jewish people will be saved and enter the kingdom. Then the pearl, speaking of the Gentiles. Again, nevertheless, in spite of the opposition, in spite of the persecution, in spite of the error, in spite of the disunity, Gentiles will come into the kingdom as well. And you know, you guys, we see this all the time out at UCI. In spite of the atheism that's out there, in spite of the indifference that's out there, you know, 90% of those students just walk on by. In spite of the opposition, we get people out there that criticize us. In spite of all that, we still see students come to faith out at UCI. That's just the world we live in, right? Exactly what we see. Of course, right. You get an A. Yeah. Clay's is out there. Cindy's out there. Anyone else out there in the class? Nope. We've seen that. In spite of all this, the gospel seed will bear fruit and Jew and Gentile will be saved. The eighth parable, the net. The age will end with the judgment of the Gentiles, unrighteous Gentiles excluded, and the righteous Gentiles taken in, and that's the conclusion of the age. And then the householder, the summary. Some aspects of the mystery kingdom are old and some are new. And if we recall that Israel is the treasure under the comments column, we see that old and new revelation came out of Israel. The old is the Tanakh, the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament. The new, of course, is the Brit Chadashah, the New Covenant, the New Testament, whatever you'd like to call it. And why? Why did this old and new come out of Israel? Well, that's covered by Paul in Romans chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. Paul answers the question, what then is the advantage, what advantage has the Jew, or what is the benefit of circumcision? You know, many a Jewish person has asked that question. I always think of Reb Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof. God, next time you choose somebody else, right? But Paul disagrees with that. He says, the benefit and the advantage is great in every respect. First of all, they were entrusted with the oracles of God. One of the jobs we were given to do was to write down God's revelation and preserve it. And we have done that. And the Dead Sea Scrolls are an example of that, how we have preserved the oracles of God. All righty. So the thing that's encouraging to me is that God has laid it all out for us, right? As we look around the world today, what do we see? We see exactly what these parables teach. These exact characteristics mark the world we live in. So when I first went through these parables as a unit, not broken apart, out of context, individually interpreted in a million different ways, but as a unit, I was greatly encouraged and greatly comforted, because what do I see? Jesus knew all about where I'm living, what I'm going through right now, and warned me about it. And that tells me that everything's under control. Not to worry. Everything is moving right down God's track. Yes? We'll get to that in just a second. We're getting there, okay? All righty, that's section 92. Let's turn over then to section 93, page 13 of your outline. And now we come to the departure across the sea and the calming of the storm. And that's on page 87 of your harmony, covered by Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And we will start in the Mark account, the middle column. Now we're going to see, as it says on the top of your outline, we're going to get a glimpse at Yeshua's power over nature in this incident. And it's going to be one of the new miracles that follow the rejection of his messiahship. But again, this miracle is not for the nation, it is for the disciples. Remember, the nation has reached its decision regarding him. So let's start with the Mark account, chapter 4, verse 35. Middle column, first verse at the top of the page. And on that day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us go over to the other side." So this is a very long, exhausting day for Yeshua. The rejection of his messiahship came. Then we learn that he went into the house on the same day and began teaching the parables. We learned that last week. And now the day is coming to an end. Evening has come. The sun is lowering over the hills of Galilee, and he wants to get into a boat and go down across the Sea of Galilee. Okay, does that answer your question? We've had these time indicators, and this is the next one. Okay. So this is the same day. It's in the evening. It's the same day as his rejection. It's the same day that the parables were taught. Now, he sends them into a very, very serious situation, very deliberately. Very deliberately. Mark chapter 4, verses 36 and 37. After leaving the multitude, remember that was the multitude that was so great that they didn't even have time to eat at the beginning of the day. And leaving the multitude, they took him along with them, just as he was, in the boat, and other boats were with him. And there arose a fierce gale of wind, and the waves were breaking over the boat so much that the boat was already filling up. So again, a very, very serious situation. The lake that was calm at the beginning of the journey suddenly is extremely tempestuous, stirred up by this wind. And you know, this can happen in just minutes on the Sea of Galilee, because the Sea of Galilee is ideally positioned for this kind of an event. Now, on the map here, you see it sitting 600 feet below sea level. And being lower than sea level, it's usually quite warm down there. And so the air is heated up and is rising. And that leaves a vacuum, right? And nature loves to fill a vacuum. And so the cold Mediterranean air will sweep down into the Sea of Galilee, and it's funneled in by three perfectly positioned valleys. We have the Valley of Beth HaKerem, and again, it funnels this cold Mediterranean air down to the Sea of Galilee. South of that is the Valley of Bet Netufah. Again, an east-west valley that is a perfect vehicle for these cold airs to come down to the Sea of Galilee. Then the Turan Valley, same phenomena, basically an east-west valley, and so every north to south, the whole Sea of Galilee can be hit by these Mediterranean winds, especially in the evening when everything is starting to cool down in the Mediterranean and the warm Sea of Galilee, the air is still rising. But there's one other source as well, And that's a little bit to the north and to the east, and that's Mount Hermon, 9,000 feet up, sometimes snow covered throughout the year, and we have some very cold air up there, and it likes to come down, sweeping down the hill there, hitting the Sea of Galilee as well. So there's all kinds of opportunity, especially in the evening, for a windstorm to pick up. And I witnessed this personally when I was in Israel in 1994-96. We were staying at Ein Gev or Ha'on, I can't remember which one, which kibbutz, at the southern end of the Sea of Galilee. And it was the end of the day. The sun had just basically set. There was just a nice glow in the sky. And I was out at the beach at the Sea of Galilee, and it was nice and calm. And before you knew it, in 15 minutes, the waves were 3 feet high and crashing onto the beach in front of me. So what was just a nice, placid sea in 15 minutes turned into a horror story for a tiny little boat. Quite amazing to me. I just watched it happen. I was glad I was not out in a tiny little boat on the Sea of Galilee that evening. And that is exactly the situation here. It's evening, and this kind of windstorm comes crashing down on the Sea of Galilee. So they are in very great danger. And this is the kind of boat they were in. Here's the boat right there. This is a fragment of mosaic found at Magdala. And that's where Mary Magdalene came from. Mary the Magdalene, Mary from Magdala. That depicts a fishing boat in the first century CE. Sails are noted in the mosaic, two oars on each side, steering oar to the right, a high stern, and a crew of five. So this boat could hold 15 with no problem. But normally it was crewed by a crew of five. Now here's a close-up of that mosaic. And that is about the only information we had about fishing boats on the Sea of Galilee until 1989. In 1989, the Sea of Galilee boat, also known as the Jesus boat, was discovered during an extremely low period of water in the Sea of Galilee. And it was excavated and brought over to Kibbutz Ginusar. Now, that doesn't look like much of a boat in that book cover, does it? Well, we'll tell you why. You can read about this story in the Sea of Galilee boat. It's a nice story by Shelley Waxman. He's the archaeologist that oversaw the excavation of the boat. Here's another picture of the boat, and this explains what it looks like. A boat recovered in 1986 from the Galilee lake bed, shown here as it was gently lifted from the lake, ensconced in a protective shell of polyurethane. See, this boat was buried in the mud. The mud protected it from disintegrating, but the wood fibers were soaked with water. And as the wood fibers began to dry, well, what happened? They began to crumble into dust. So they kept the boat very, very wet, and so that the wood fibers would be supported by the water. How are we going to move this thing to a safe place? Well, they got the idea of covering it entirely in this polyurethane shell, which they did, and then floated it from its position, maybe 100 yards to the south of Kibbutz Ginosar. They floated over there, and here you can see the cables from the crane that are going to attach to the wooden supports, and they're going to lift this the boat safely into a protective vat in Kibbutz Ginosar. Now, if you go to the museum there at the kibbutz these days, you can see a mock-up of the polyurethane shell that was created. And you can see a picture in the background taken just a few seconds after the previous one that I showed you. But there you can get an idea of what they created to protect this very, very, very fragile boat. And it was dumped into this chemical preservation tank. They had to replace the water in the wood fibers with some kind of non-evaporative substance, a plastic substance. So they dumped it into this water, and they slowly increased the percentage of chemistry in that water over the years. I think it was a 10-year immersion period. I think it was about 10 years. And eventually, the chemistry in the water, the plastic in the water, pushed out the water molecules and stayed in place and dried and supported the, I don't know how else to explain it, supported the wood fibers with plastic rather than water, which would dry out. And once that preservation period was over, you can now take a look at the boat in the Galilee Boat Museum at Kibbutz Ginosar. And there it is in all its glory. Now, for those of you who have not been to Israel, that may be a very ho-hum picture. That may be very kind of a drab picture. What's the big deal about that hunk of, that hulk there? Well, go to that museum when you go to Israel, stand 2 feet away from that thing, and realize that men 2,000 years ago had built that thing and used that thing on a daily basis, and a funny feeling comes over you. That boat is, that display is much more impressive in life than I can picture it here on this photograph. So reserve your judgment till you get there and stand in front of that that amazing boat. It's about 23 feet long. What's left of it is about 23 feet long. Now, there is no association of this boat with Jesus. Absolutely none, even though it got the name the Jesus boat. But it is from the period. And you know what? I've often thought somebody should write a screenplay built around the boat. Built around the boat, starting from the history of when it was built, how it was used by fishermen, put Jesus into it, you know, have him use it, and then finish up with the war against the Romans on the Sea of Galilee in 70 AD, and you'd have a fascinating movie, I think. Okay? Yeah. Question?
Do you know if there are any metal fasteners like nails?
Yes, there are nails. Are they metal or not? I know there's wooden plugs. I'd have to go look at the book again to remember exactly how it was constructed. But there are wooden plugs. I'm not sure there are nails. Now, you have this drawing on the next page of your outline, page 14, comes from the book, and a photograph of the boat itself. Here is a model in the museum of the boat at its height. That's the way it looked when it was brand new, and quite a neat neat little fishing boat. All righty, now I'm going to go into your break a little bit, but let's finish up section 93 here. So that's the kind of boat they were in. Now, what's the purpose of sending them out into this dangerous situation? Well, Jesus has a purpose for them, and that purpose is to teach them to depend on him. Let's pick it up on verses 38 through 40. Mark chapter 4, verses 38 through 40. And he himself was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And being aroused, he rebuked the wind, and he said to the sea, "Hush, be still." And the wind died. The wind died down, and it became perfectly calm. And he said to them, "Why are you so timid? How is it that you have no faith?" Well, first of all, he's sleeping in the stern. That would indicate that Jesus was absolutely exhausted, because here he's in the this boat that's going right, left, up and down, jerking all over the place, and he's asleep. He's able to sleep. That means the activities of the day have just worn him out. Excuse me? He might have had a cushion. It doesn't say he's there necessarily. He said he had a, you know, pillow, but... So he is so sound asleep that he has to get awakened. So he's had a long day. He's been working overtime. He's exhausted. Now, they plead with him, and he says he rebukes the winds. And the Greek word used there is the word for muzzled. He muzzled the winds. So the picture here is that the wind is like a wild animal attacking the boat. And he puts a muzzle over the snout, and it's rendered harmless. Then note, he describes them as timid. Interesting word. The Greek word means to be afraid or to be cowards. Why are you cowards? So he's expecting them to be brave. He's expecting them to be even braver than they already are through faith in God. You see, these guys, some of these guys are seasoned, brave fishermen. This is not the first time they've been in something like this. It's not their first barbecue. You're right. In this case, it's a sailing ship. Okay? So he wants them to move beyond what they're normally able to do. So the lesson is, don't depend on your human courage. exceed your human courage through faith in me. He's calling us to have great courage. And you know, that is a common exhortation in the Bible. For example, when we're ready, here's a slide I forgot to show you. Here's a close-up of the back of the boat where he's sleeping. There's that little platform. So he's sleeping somewhere back there. All right, this exhortation to have courage is a common one in the Bible. For example, in Joshua chapter 1, verses 6 through 9, we're going to enter the promised land. And what do we read in those three verses? Be strong and courageous. Be strong and courageous. Be strong and courageous. Do not tremble or be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. And you know, we have storms come into our lives like this, don't we? We have situations that come into our lives that try our courage. But you know, we can go beyond what we're humanly able to do. We place our trust in our God who is with us, who will always be with us, okay? Just like the disciples. All right, the disciples' response. We'll look at the Matthew account, verse 27, bottom of page 87 there, left-hand column. And the men marveled, saying, "What kind of man is this that even the winds and the sea obey him?" Well, remember, these guys are experienced fishermen. They had gone through storms in the Sea of Galilee, but this storm is different. Why? Because the sea calmed down when the wind calmed down. Now, if the wind calms down, it usually takes the sea a lot longer to stop sloshing back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. But in this instant, it all calms down together. He has power over the wind and the sea, and it's very obvious that his power is different than the natural. It exceeds the natural. And so it's now more frightening for them to have God in the boat than to have that storm outside the boat. Right? So Jesus has just become their leader in the area of courage. Be strong and courageous. And so you guys can be strong and courageous as we take our break. And I've taken you halfway into it, so I'll give you most of it back. But try to come back soon. All right, now we'll pick it up then on section 94, lesson 6, page 15 at the top, section 94. So we just just finished up section 93, where Jesus is challenging his disciples to be strong and courageous. Why are you so timid? Well, they're going to need courage to face this next incident, the healing of the Gerasene demoniac and resultant opposition. Now, we've seen Yeshua's power over nature in the previous section. Now we're going to see his power over the spiritual world, his power over demons. And in this section, we get the first detailed description of a demonized state. Up till now, The Gospels have only said that the person had a demon, something like that. Now we get a look at what it actually looks like. We see what it actually looks like. So let's begin with the description in Mark chapter 5, verses 1 through 5. Section 94 is on page 88. Again, covered by Matthew, Mark, and Luke, so we're in the middle column, Mark. And let's take a look at verses 1 through 5. "And they came to the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gerasenes. And when he had come out of the boat, immediately a man from the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. And he had his dwelling among the tombs, and no one was able to bind him anymore, even with a chain. Because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been torn apart by him, and the shackles broken in pieces, and no one was strong enough to subdue him. And constantly, night and day, among the tombs and in the mountains, he was crying out and gashing himself with stones." Now, I would definitely be afraid of this guy. I don't know about you guys. Where's my courage? I'd stay in the boat. I'd stay in the boat. All right, now, this is the first detailed description of a demonized state. Why now? Why do we get this description now? It lies in the fact that the one who was accused of being demonized, Jesus was accused of being demonized. That's the basis for his rejection. The one who was accused of being demonized is now face to face with one in an extreme case of being demonized. First of all, we see that the Messiah is binding the Lord of the false kingdom. This shows that he has power over Satan, not the other way around. If the accusation had been true, if Yeshua had been demonized by Beelzebub, the prince of demons, Yeshua would have behaved like this man. That's the way Yeshua would have been behaving. But he's not. He is going to exert his power over the demon world. Okay, the location. This takes place in Gadara, which is a region on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee, and Gergesa is a city within that region. And we really have no idea where this incident took place. There are four suggested locations. Three are prominent. One is really quite minor. On the top of this map, you see Capernaum, where they were, where they started out. That's where the multitudes pressed around them so much they couldn't even eat. That's where the rejection of his messiahship took place. That's where the teaching in parables took place. Now the day has come to a close, and they have are going to leave from Capernaum. Now they're going to head down to the region of Gadara. That's down here in the south, the southern eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. Now one prominent location for this incident is called Kersi, although I don't think it's the best location because it is actually located in Hippus. It's not located in Gadara, so it's not really in the right location, but it is the traditional location for the miracle. And when you go to Kersi, you can visit this Byzantine-era church. The remains of this church was set up to mark the location of the miracle. Now, you can see it's made out of black basalt, like so many of the buildings in that area, because black basalt is such a common stone there, volcanic rock. So this is one location. There's also a harbor there at Kersi, and you can see from this picture that the land does slope down to the Sea of Galilee, which will fit the incident correctly. And here's another view of the landscape at Kersi. Again, the landscape swooping down to the Sea of Galilee, which will fits into the incident. So Kersi, that's one of the locations that is prominent. Another location is thought to be Hippus, to the south of Kersi. This is Hippus. You can see it very, very distinctly from the Sea of Galilee, this flat-top hill, also called Susita today. Here, our boat is approaching Ein Gev, Kibbutz Ein Gev in the foreground. And from Kibbutz Ein Gev, here's a little bit of a close-up of Hippus or Susita. And yes, again, the land does descend to the Sea of Galilee, so it is possible that this fits the incident as well. But again, I don't think it's the best location. So Kersi and Hippus are two prominent locations. The least logical location would be Sennabris, which is on the west side of the Sea of Galilee. It doesn't really fit at all. I don't know why it's considered a location, but it is considered a possible location. Now, the best possible location, I think, for this incident is Ais Samra, located here at the southern end of the Sea of Galilee. That seems to be the best location to me of the three prominent ones. Now, I believe you have this map in your outline on page 16. This map comes from Mendel Nun's book, The Sea of Galilee. He was an archaeologist who excavated all of the all of the harbors around the Sea of Galilee. And here to the south, you see the harbor of Gadara. Now, here's a close-up of the southern end of the Sea of Galilee. And again, here is the harbor of Gadara. Now, Gadara was not located on the Sea of Galilee, but this harbor apparently supported the city. And you can see on the right-hand side, there's a hill, a slope located in that area. And it's right where Kibbutz Ha'on is located today. So I think this is probably the best area for this incident to take place. So the southern end of the Sea of Galilee, it is located in the correct region. It is associated with the correct city. And the topography seems proper as well. So they leave from Capernaum. Jesus is dog-tired. He's asleep on the back of the boat. And this windstorm comes up, jostles them around, scares them to death. And Jesus calms the wind. That's exactly what happened. That's just PowerPoint animation, you guys. That's all it is. Same boat, of course, that we saw in the previous slides, the Jesus boat. Jesus calms the storm, and they continue to the south down to Samra. So it's a good little journey by boat down to this location. Oh, how long is that? I don't remember right now exactly how long that is. All righty.
Have you been here?
To Samra. I was at Kibbutz Ha'on, yes, many years ago. And the road goes right through that territory as you go around the lake. So you go right by it. It's not a primary location. Most everybody goes up to Kersey, because that's a traditional location.
We went to Kersey.
Oh, yeah, we went to Kersey, yeah. All right. Now, the important thing to note is back on page 15, last comment, that this is Gentile territory. This is Gentile territory. Very, 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 very few Jewish people lived here. This is the Decapolis, a confederation of 10 Gentile cities in this area. So keep that in mind. Question. It isn't shown on that map. I'll show you. You will have a map on the next page that shows Gergesa, where it's located in the Decapolis. Okay, it's not the biggest map in the world, but it is there on the next page. All righty. Now turning to page 17. The demoniac immediately recognizes Jesus. So we get a look at demonic knowledge as we look at Matthew 8:29. So Matthew 8:29, the Matthew account, is the left-hand column, bottom of page 88, verse 29. "And behold, they cried out, saying, 'What have we to do with you, Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time?'" Now, did you notice that the Mark and the Luke account speak of one demoniac, but Matthew speaks of two. And the explanation is at the bottom of the page. See the footnote at the bottom of the page? Apparently, there were two demon-possessed men, but Mark and Luke single out the one who was the leader, or maybe it might be better to say the one who had the conversation with Jesus. That apparently is the focus and the difference between the two of them. All right, so we learn what demons know at this point. First of all, demons know who Jesus is. They immediately recognize him as the Son of God. And secondly, they know their own doom. They know that they will spend an eternity in torment. See, there's no salvation for angels, you guys. There's no salvation for fallen angels. Only for men. Only for mankind. So these guys are destined for an eternity in torment. Now, Jesus uses the Jewish method of exorcism at this particular time. Remember, the Jewish method was to learn the name of the demon and therefore have authority over it and then cast it out. Mark 5:9. The Mark account, we're on page 89, middle column, verse 9 in the middle column. "And he was asking him, 'What is your name?' And he said to him, "My name is Legion, for we are many." Now, a Roman legion, this guy names himself after a Roman legion. A Roman legion consisted of between 3,000 and 6,000 soldiers. So it's possible that this guy had a minimum of 3,000 demons in him. Demons are spiritual beings. They're not limited by space and time. So whether he had 3,000 in him or 6,000 in him or it's just a round number, the point is the same. He is extremely demonized. He is in a severe case. Well, it says so in the text. He says so in the text. My name is Legion, for we are many. Okay, see, it's the text that gives us that. All right, now let's turn to look at the highlight of the abyss in the middle of page 17. And let's pick it up on the Luke account, verse 31. So just drop over to the right, to the Luke account, and pick up verse 31. And they were entreating him not to command them to depart into the abyss. Now, what is the abyss? The abyss is a temporary place of confinement for fallen angels. For example, we see that in Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 through 3. John says, "Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding the key of the abyss and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he threw him into the abyss and shut it and sealed it over him so that he would not deceive the nations any longer until the 1,000 years were completed. After these things, he must be released for a short time." So again, a place of confinement for demons. Some are there now and will be released later during the tribulation period. Some are sent there now and still confined. We see in the future, Satan will be sent there and confined for 1,000 years. Yes?
Is there any evidence that that's the same abyss between Lazarus and
the Greek? There's no evidence of that, of the great gulf being the same. It seems to be something entirely different. All right, now these demons ask to be sent into a herd of swine, and we'll learn that there were 2,000 swine, 2,000 pigs, and part of that herd, so it's quite a large herd. So he gives them permission toward the bottom of the page there, and that's in the Mark account, verses 11 through 13. Now there was a big herd of swine feeding there on the mountain, and the demons entreated him, saying, "Send us into the swine so that we may enter them." And he gave them permission. And coming out, the unclean spirits entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea, about 2,000 of them, and they were drowned in the sea. So permission is granted. So who's in charge here? Jesus is in charge here, right. He is in charge of the demons, not the reverse. Yes, Bonnie.
I always wondered why they wanted to go into the pigs, but it just occurred to me that they were probably asking to go there instead of into the abyss.
Well, that's exactly it. Yeah, they prefer to be in the pigs rather than to be in torment. The lesser of two evils. So Jesus grants permission and showing that he's dominating the powers of hell. They do not dominate him. So they enter the pigs, and what do the pigs do? The pigs commit mass suicide by running down the slope into the lake. So, that will be on the review next week. That will be in the review next week, definitely. Okay. All right, now it looks, you know, one thing we learn here is that pigs will not tolerate being indwelt by demons. But, you know, people do. People tolerate it, yes. They were disembodied, so they went out looking for another body to inhabit. Remember the story of how things were worse at the end than the beginning? The demons went out of the man. He was in dry and waterless places. He didn't like it, so he found another person.
So they just keep going from body to body?
I don't know. I'm not an expert in demons. But they don't like to be disembodied. That's all I can say. Whether it be pigs or people. Okay? They don't like to be disembodied somewhere for some reason. So that's all I can say. All right. Now, the common question, why did Jesus give permission for them to do this? The common answer, most commentaries will say, because owning pigs was not permitted in the Mosaic law, so he allowed unclean spirits to enter unclean animals. But that is not true, because this is Gentile territory. And the Gentiles are allowed to own pigs and eat pigs. So the answer, the true answer, is we don't know why. It's never stated. So when you call up the Bible answer man and he gives you an answer, an honest answer would be, we don't know why. We don't know why. All right, let's take a look at the responses. Question.
Is this man, do we know if he's Jewish?
We'll learn that he's Gentile in just a second. All right, let's turn to page 18, next page, the responses to this miracle. The herdsman's response is found in verses 14 through 17. Verses 14 through 17. So that is the Mark account, the middle column, bottom of the page. And their herdsmen ran away and reported it in the city and out in the country. And the people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and observed the man who had been demon-possessed sitting down, clothed, and in his right mind, the very man who had the legion. And they became frightened. And those who had seen it described to them how it had happened to the demon-possessed man and all about the swine, and they began to entreat him to depart from their region. So the pig owners, the herdsmen, report the event to the surrounding region, and the inhabitants of the surrounding region are struck with fear, and they ask Jesus to leave. They really reject him. They're not responding properly to the miracle. Now, the demonized man's response is very different in verses 18 through 20. And as he was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed was entreating him that he might accompany him. And he did not let him, but he said to him, "Go home to your people and report to them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in Decapolis what great things Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. So this man is asking to become a disciple, and Jesus says no. Why does he say no to this man's desire to become a disciple? Well, because this man is a Gentile. And at this point in his ministry, the way is not yet open to Gentiles. Jesus has come for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So rather than becoming a disciple of Jesus at this point, he's given a different job. He's told to become a witness about Jesus. Now, the policy of silence about his messiahship, he's going to stop proclaiming his messiahship to Israel. The policy of silence applies only to the Jewish community because of our rejection of his messiahship. It doesn't apply to the Gentiles. So he can't become a disciple, but he can become a witness. And again, this map is in the middle of page 18. And this is the Decapolis right here. And on your map and on this map, you can see Gadara. This is the city that is supported by the harbor over here. Gadara was a distance from the Sea of Galilee in that region. But this is the Decapolis. It is a confederation of 10 Greek cities, 10 polis cities. Literally, the Greek there is 10 cities, Decapolis. Okay? And we will see the results of this man's ministry later. So he leaves the area of the Sea of Galilee and he goes into this region preaching Jesus. And again, we will see the results of his ministry later on. So he's hogging all the attention, says Roger. All right. He rose to the occasion, right. Question.
So he was not allowed to become a disciple of Jesus.
At this moment.
At this moment.
Yes.
Yes, so that's what we'll learn later on.
Yeah, down the road, when the gospel is now free to go to the Gentiles, then he will become a disciple of Jesus directly. Yes, or I should say of the church. He probably won't see Jesus directly after the resurrection, but he will become. Yeah, he'll be in the church. He'll be a disciple. Yes.
Well, I mean, it's not really fair.
Well, we can't answer that question. We don't know what opened this man up to demonism. It appears that unrighteous behavior opens you up to that. So, it's just not something that happens to everybody, because if it was, we'd all be in deep trouble.
Well, he's
grateful because he's just come through a horrible experience. Years of being demonized and living in this state of being insane, living out naked out in the tombs, gashing himself, it was a horrible existence. So, of course he's very grateful. Yeah, very, very grateful. Question?
In other instances, when Jesus has healed somebody, he'll say, your faith has saved you, go and sin no more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's not recorded here. That's not recorded, yeah. Yeah, that's interesting too there. Yeah, all the details. Well, when we meet this guy, it'll be interesting to talk with him. Yeah, when we run into him. Okay, another, yeah, question.
Many more instances of the same thing happening. You said they didn't write everything down in the Bible.
Oh, yeah.
So as far as this individual being chosen, that was God's will.
Yeah, in fact, let's point out that Jesus had an extremely long day. He was working overtime. He takes his disciples out in the middle of the sea to teach him a lesson, but he has this man in mind too.
Yes,
he has the salvation of this man in mind, and even though he's tremendously exhausted, he's willing to do that, to begin his proclamation of his messiahship to the Gentiles out in the Decapolis. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
What it really meant.
Right.
So to me it's a beautiful illustration that God was giving to them.
Yes, he was teaching them many lessons to have courage and that I am in control of the demons. No question. Here's an extreme state. I take care of it. Extreme state of demonism. I take care of it. Yes.
I mean, same day.
Yes, same day.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a long day, you guys. This was a busy day. Amazing. I'd be exhausted too. Question. Is this the first? No, it isn't. Because remember, early in his ministry, people were coming from all over that area to be healed into Galilee. So many Gentiles had been coming in to receive the benefits of his ministry, even though his aim is to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, he still was performing miracles for masses, etc. All right, we're okay, you guys. You got one more question, okay? Right.
Kind of reminds me of that story.
Yeah, he was. This guy has been basically turned into an animal. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. One last question, Carol.
I just want to say, never undermine the value of a nap.
Never underestimate the value of a nap. Good. Even if it's on a rocking boat. Right. Okay. All right. Let me pray. And I'll turn you guys loose, and we'll pick it up next week on section 95. Jesus will return to Galilee. All right. Shh. Father, again, we want to thank you for your word. Thank you for our Savior and the exhausting ministry that he was willing to perform that led to our salvation that was on the behalf of Israel and on our behalf. And Lord, help us to assimilate that message of courage. We may not be out in the middle of the Sea of Galilee struck by a windstorm, but many, many windstorms can enter our lives and cause us to tremble and shake and feel like we're going to sink, we're going to go under. But if we trust in you, we can rise above our limited human courage and gain a courage from you that will take us further than we ever dream possible. Help us to do that in our daily lives. And help us to be people that are so different, living lives so different, lives full of courage, that we stand out among those among us and are bright and shining light and can share with them their need to come to spiritual wholeness in Jesus, just as that demoniac was brought to spiritual wholeness. So it's in Yeshua's name that we pray. Amen.